I think we don't think about how intelligent the babies are. Like, you know, they're so intelligent. They'll tell you when they're ready to feed, and they have a series of little things they do. And if we watch that every single time, they're ready to go. So their cues, I call them their cues, and they give the cues. And when they give the cues, and the mother says, "I've been watching that, I didn't really know." So why aren't we using that as prenatal information? You know, we should be sharing the cues, what the baby does. In lots, the baby will tell you when it's had enough.
Getting pregnant and giving birth are two of the most exciting things you can ever hope to experience in this life. The moment you think you could be pregnant, you're frantically searching for all the best information, which is why you're here today. I'm Stephanie King, and with my many years of experience as a professional childbirth educator, doula, and lover of all things pregnancy, birth, and postpartum, I'm here to make preparing for your birth enjoyable, empowering, and totally easy. Each week, I'll cover different topics, interview professionals, and get into the nitty-gritty birth stories from mamas just like you. And when you're ready for more, you can join me in the My Essential Birth course at myessentialbirth.com, where I take you step by step through exactly how to prepare your mind, body, spirit, and partner for a birth you love. So let's get started. Welcome back to the podcast. This week's reviewer of the week is LBG1188. She says, "I feel so prepared and I'm not even pregnant yet. I love when you guys find this podcast and you're not even pregnant. That is so awesome for you to even be thinking about it." She says, "I started listening when I was around 6 weeks pregnant and I cannot get enough of this podcast. I'm now 25 weeks and will be signing up for the birth course this weekend. I already feel so much more prepared and well-educated about pregnancy and birth just from listening and can't wait to start the course. I love how all the information is presented in an objective way for you to interpret and make educated decisions on your own. I highly recommend this podcast to all my pregnant friends and even anyone who is trying to become pregnant. I look forward to continuing to listen and learn." Thank you so much for your review. And as I'm reading this, oh, I see. I started listening when I was around 6 weeks pregnant and can't get enough. That's so fun. I love when you guys find this stuff early and then you eat it up. That's what I wish I would have done myself. This week, I have a very exciting, very special guest for you. Her name is Dr. Robin Thompson. She has a PhD. She is an experienced midwife, family, child, and maternal health nurse, breastfeeding specialist, and the founder of the Thompson Method breastfeeding program. So for nearly five decades, thousands of women and their babies have experienced the benefits of her gentle and intuitive method of breastfeeding, and I'm hoping to dive a little bit deeper with her on that topic today. So with that, Dr. Thompson, it is a pleasure to have you here. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Stephanie. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, I have looked into your information online, and it's fun because your stuff keeps popping up in my feed, and I never want to scroll away. I'm always like, yes, that's so useful. Yes, that was another piece of information that is so, you know, so important for moms to know. So will you tell me just a little bit about your background and how you kind of got into doing what you do today that serves so many thousands of women?
Well, I can start with saying my life has been a journey. I haven't planned my life at all. I haven't planned my career. The only thing I did do is go nursing in 1961. So 62 years ago. I've been in the health system in Australia for 62 years. And then I decided that when I'd been home with my children, that I'd like to do something, and I was going to go back to nursing. And then I thought, no, let's try something else. So I did midwifery, and I was accepted into midwifery. I finished midwifery, and 3 months after I finished, I was called down the corridor by the director of nursing, and she was telling me that in 2 weeks I was going to be in charge of the labour ward.
Oh, my goodness.
So for the next 10 years or more, if I have to think about the dates, I was in charge of a public hospital labour ward, which I had amazing experience and always protected women. And I was known for that, put a few medical people out of they weren't real happy sometimes, but that's okay because my role is to protect women, look after them, nurture them, and encourage them to follow their unique. Every person on the planet is unique. No two are the same. to follow their unique instincts and their own maternal knowledge. And lots of times we are coerced into things that we don't really need to do or we don't really want to do, except in cases where there is a genuine emergency. And that's when the senior obstetrician takes over, not the juniors. And so, you know, there's lots of stories to that time. And then by invitation, I went to a home birth and that inspired me. And I then continued on for 50 years with birthing at home with women. No, sorry, of that 50 years of midwifery, 25 of those were birthing at home with women. And it was such a pleasure to learn so much more from women. You know, women teach us so much if we have the time to listen and observe quietly and not invade their space and be beside them rather than dominant over them. And so I avoid all those things that place women in control as much as I possibly can. Of course, we have to look after the woman that needs special help. And that's without doubt, and the baby too. But most of the times I'm working with women. And then I was doing some work with the Maternal and Child Health Service, and I had kept long databases from my own private practice. And then I started using that database for my maternal and child health home visits and anybody I saw with breastfeeding through the Maternal and Child Health Service. And then I had a huge database. And then that became the basis of my PhD when I presented at a conference and three very guru people in this country approached me to do a master's. After 1 year, I agreed. Took me a long time because I really didn't have that in my head. It was a journey. I didn't know that that was coming. So I started the master's. And I got through 1 year. I achieved a whole year and ready to go into the next year when I was called up to the head office. That's scary too. And and informed that my master's had been converted to a PhD. They were so pleased with what I'd done. So then I worked for nigh on 6 years with three of the guru professors of this country who guided me through becoming an academic. So I didn't plan anything. Nothing was planned.
That's a really neat journey to listen to and to think that you kind of were able to make. I appreciate you sharing that. Yeah.
It still surprises me now. I think, well, how did that happen?
I think those are the best stories, though, where we feel like we're being guided along the way. That's really neat. I think that's very special.
Yeah.
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 Something that you do today. Yeah. And I'm grateful you're here. Anyways, I was unaware that you existed at all until recently. And then as I have looked further and further into your work, I'm like, you are such a blessing to the pregnant and birthing community. And so to hear some of that backstory is pretty neat. And I love how you talk about being an advocate for women and everything that you do for them. It is so important and so needed. So with that, though, something that you talk about is the influence of labor and birth and the choices that we make during that time on breastfeeding success. And I assume that comes from, as you were saying, your many, many years of helping women to get through the birthing process and onto postpartum and then visiting them postpartum. Can you take a moment and talk about that?
Yes, I think I probably wouldn't have understood this as clearly as I do now, being with women, but during the, I had to have answers to my questions in my head. So I would delve further all the time into the anatomy. So my understanding of how the oral cavity works was very fortunate in that I was able to have women pain-free after one feed. So understanding that was just so, and understanding that unique mother, her unique breast, her unique nipple, and her unique baby without thinking that everybody has to do the same thing, because they don't. And how we handle and treat the baby as well, because babies are highly sensitive to what we do. And most mothers wouldn't do that to their babies if it was left to them to do. So I think I learnt a lot from by observing quietly and listening to the women and picking up what they were saying. Because when you pick up what they say, they already have the answer if they have a question, right? They already know. So if I draw on their knowledge and their knowing about themselves, that's the most important, then often we have really, you know, good outcomes. And, of course, doing the research I did the research of the craniocervical spine. I understood exactly how the baby, you know, came to the breast, what it was doing with the underlying structures and how it's sensitive, so sensitive to touch, pads of fingers, pads of toes, how it's smelling, tasting and knowing all the time. So babies are highly, highly intelligent. And if we draw on that, we can learn to be really calm and gentle with them, and that helps the mother too. But my role is to nurture the mother because she'll always look after her baby. So if there's a difficult situation, then we help her. And we don't have rules in my practice. I don't have rules. I don't like rules. I would obliterate all the rules if I could because rules put people under pressure. And it doesn't, you're not using your own self-knowledge, your own self-needs, your own instincts, and not being benefited by having rules for everything. And some of the examples of that would be baby's weight. Everything's taken on the graph for the babies of the world, yet each individual unique baby comes from a genetical background. So that genetics is different for every single baby. So some families are tall and those babies don't spread out quickly. They grow tall. Their head size is growing, but they're not growing out. And so that becomes a problem, and that then becomes a fear for the mother because her baby's not putting on enough weight. And that's happening a lot, a real lot. But when you look at the picture of the baby's perfect. It's growing, skin turgor is good, colour's good, it's communicating, it's active, and its output is good. So if the output's good, that's your primary indicator because it wouldn't be coming in if the output wasn't good. So I take that sort of approach with them to give it back to them and to let them think about it, because they'll tell me, well, I think my baby's fine. You know, but there's a fear then, and we're calling it here now, fear by coercion. Yeah, so, yeah, and I also talk about there's no break in between pregnancy, labour, birth. They're transitions to breastfeeding, and birth to breastfeeding is a transition. So if we separate the mother and baby, her baby, at birth unnecessarily, or we don't leave the cord intact and we want to cut it all the time, then we're depriving the baby and we're depriving the mother. So, you know, this is a mother who, it's her baby. She's grown that baby. She's felt every movement of that baby. She knows her baby was drinking because every time it drinks the amniotic fluid, it hiccups. So she has more knowledge than everybody, really, but we don't have the time, often the time in the system, or the patience to listen to her. It's get the job done and tick the box, especially here. I don't know what it's like where you are, but in Florida. But it is definitely, you know, get everything done, get her through the system as quickly as you can. And it takes a lot more than that to nurture a mother and her baby and reassure her and talk with her, not talk to her or over her.
Yeah, I had something similar with my first baby. I think some of these situations are, you know, why I do what I do today, and I am with you 100% on everything that you're saying. My baby, when he was about 6 months old, my first one, and I am short. I am 5 feet. My husband is 5'9". We're both tiny people. But that baby wasn't putting on weight the way that the provider wanted to see. And so they started calling him failure to thrive. And while my husband was away for a couple months for work, the provider sent us to the hospital. It was a children's hospital. And I, the whole time, I'm like, I feel like my baby's fine. But then I was worried, I'm not making enough breast milk. He might not be eating enough, all that stuff. It was a lactation consultant at the hospital, and they looked at him, same thing. He's fine. He's moving around. He's maybe even ahead for some of these milestones. She weighed him before and after. She looked at output. Your baby's fine. all the while having to feel so stressed with my pediatrician that, like, now I feel like I can't trust myself. Something must be wrong with my baby. So I think what you're talking about is extremely important, is putting that maternal intuition, that maternal knowledge back where it belongs with the mother who knows her baby best. And then taking all those other things into the whole scope of it.
I feel sorry for the mothers in those circumstances. And I have hundreds of stories,
Sure.
This, and a recent one was a pediatrician telling the mother the baby has to go onto cow's milk and that baby's now covered in eczema, and she was breastfeeding beautifully. So I think we've got to take a step back, and we've got to learn the effects also of the opiates used in anaesthetics. Of course, if you have a general anaesthetic, you need to have pain relief. That's absolutely in order. But the number of women that have opiates that could have sterile water injections with no effect on the baby or themselves. But, we see the effect of the sleepy syndrome baby, and it takes much longer for the baby to connect and gather its energy and strength to coordinate breastfeeding. We see that all the time. And so we talk with women in pregnancy as much as possible about avoiding opioids. And there are, if you look at the papers and the research, there are papers on sterile water injections from Europe and from here in Australia, and that can create pain-free within seconds. You get a bleb under the skin, that tiny bleb, then hits the nerve endings and you feel, whoo, takes your breath away for a little while, and then bingo, the pain's gone. So I had it tested on me because I had a pain in my hip, and I had it tested on me, and bingo, I had days of pain-free, and then it was settling down. So I think we do have to take a broader look at what is available for women if they need help, but also to step back if they don't, because their journey is amazing and they sense and feel and know the descent of their baby. And most of all, don't rupture the membranes, the forewaters, because that's hydraulic pressure that benefits the baby as the uterus contracts and retracts, It gives the baby a buffer, gives the baby fluid to drink during labour, and mums will feel their babies hiccuping during labour. So it's very important that that mother's body deals with the things and her baby together, because there's no two pelvises exactly the same. They're similar, and we have models of them that make them look the same, but they work differently depending on their baby, what their baby's doing in the uterus and how their baby's descending and what their baby's doing with flexion of the head or deflection of the head or, posterior position. And that's where I like to use my fingertips with the mum's consent. Always never touch her body without her consent, and then feel her baby's position, station and lie, and then take her hands and show her how to feel it too. And when the woman's in labour, you listen to the fetal heart rate every so often, and you're following it as it comes down. So you're seeing it come down. It's just near the shoulder. So there's so many things that we could relearn, that women do not need to be put under the pressure that they are at the moment in this part of history. I think back to the women of the past and wonder how they got on.
I wonder the same. Yeah.
And I understand, as a midwife of many years, and especially through the hospital system as well, there are problems, and we have to be able to deal with the problems with that mother, her specific problem. So it's very important that we recognise that too, and we're aware, And so I think roughly 1,000 home birth women, I had a 2% transfer rate. And never by ambulance do we transfer. We always talked about what might benefit her if we went in. And then I would call my colleagues who were beautiful. I had no problems with my colleagues, and they would help and work things out together. And then it was not just you were excluded when you got there. I have had colleagues who have been excluded, which is wrong because you've been with that mother the whole of her pregnancy. And it's wrong to do that. But, it is there's always a hiccup somewhere. Not that sort of a hiccup in there, but a hiccup,
right.
hiccup in the system. A hiccup in the system. Yeah.
With that in mind, what can moms during pregnancy do then to help set themselves up for success with breastfeeding during pregnancy?
So tune into their own instinct always. And sometimes it'll be a bit confusing. The brain's like a merry-go-round. It goes round and round. And then it comes to the point where, yes, that's right, I think I'll do that. You know, but the most important thing for me is to understand that no one can touch your body without your consent. So understanding the law of consent, the legislation of consent, wherever that is in any country. And it's well known here. And the law of consent is so important because you have the right to you have the right to be informed. You have the right to not accept the information they're giving, the benefits, the risks, the alternatives. You have the right to think about it. You have the right to say no, and you have the right to seek another opinion. And when you know that, that gives you a little bit more confidence if you do not feel comfortable with what's happening. You know, it's and then, you know, if it is a benefit in the long run and the coercion's gone on and you can't cope with it anymore, that's when all the intervention starts and the fear builds up. And when the fear builds up, that makes labour much harder, makes giving birth much harder, it makes breastfeeding much harder because, you know, your whole energy and strength is based on fear. And also the hormones you're producing too is based on fear as well.
Have you noticed, as you're talking about this, it makes me wonder,
yeah. Well, then that generally follows on to them being separated from their babies at birth. Or so now there's the big move for mothers to say, no, I want my baby with me. I don't want my baby taken when the APGAR score is 7 or above. So when you do the APGAR score on the baby, if it's 7 or above, the baby is with the mother. And if the baby is taken, they move things close to the mother, so she can communicate with her baby, she can touch. And instead of the father going to the trolley where it's separated from the mother, we make the baby close to the mother so they can do what they need to do, so the mother's communicating with the baby. Can touch, that's really important too.
Yeah, it's always confused me. Yes, I feel like that should be common knowledge, or it just seems so natural that, like, of course, when a mom has a baby, it would stay with her. But it's so interesting that it's becoming common to remove, to separate, anyways.
Yeah, that doesn't help the mother and it doesn't help the baby. She has warmly carried her baby for all that time, and then suddenly a whole lot of different smells are coming in. People are handling the baby, and when you look at some of the handling, it's so rough. You wonder how that little baby's feeling with that. I even worry about cesarean sections when they've got the baby by the head and they're dragging it out. The torticollis of the neck is quite evident. There's no, you know, we see it during the breastfeeding period. We see so many things that probably they wouldn't see because we're with the mother, you know, for the journey of how long she needs it for. It's all based on my research too. You know, my research and the evidence in my research showed that the three most common problems was nipple trauma, breast engorgement and mastitis. And then not so common, thank goodness, was breast abscess. But, you know, when you look at the research and do what I did and had all that evidence, it was really worrying, and I had to know why was this happening. You know, it's, I don't know, I'm just born to ask questions. I was a breech baby, right? I was sucking my toes. Yeah. So my hamstrings are magic. My hamstrings now, I can still touch the floor, and I'm about to turn 80 in a week.
That's amazing. I love that.
And I think, and my mum gave birth to me in a birthing home, not in a hospital, as a breech baby with her obstetrician at the time and the midwife at the time. Yeah.
That's really neat.
Yeah. So sucking your toes is apparently, you know, to, well, it's to do with the extended legs and called the Frank Beach or the extended breech. Yeah.
That's great.
Maybe that's something, made me more determined.
Yeah. I love that that's part of your story, though, that you work with all these births and that that's how you were born. I think that's pretty neat. Something that you talk about is, so, and I talk a lot about this golden hour, right? So after baby is born and they're put onto your chest or onto your stomach and they're not removed for an entire hour, you guys get to smell each other and touch and do all of the things that a bonding mother and baby would be able to do. You refer to it as the three golden hours. Will you tell us about that?
Yes. Yes, sure. And that's because of my experience at home birth, right? Not all babies will go to the breast or do the things that are expected within an hour. And I have video clips of little babies taking their time and they're looking at their mother and they're touching and they're feeling and they're moving towards the breast, and it might take an hour, might take half an hour, might take an hour. It might take some babies 2 hours. And so, again, that's why I think that taking a baby in an hour to do routine procedures is wrong. I don't think that's a good idea, in other words, because we don't know until you watch those little babies what they're actually doing. And they actually do work with the mother, and she knows. She's working with her baby. And working, that's not the right word. She's gently guiding, and the baby's guiding her. So between them, they're intertwined. They know. And so we don't take enough time to spend watching that, and we want to wrap babies up tight, and then we also want, someone wants to take them to weigh them and measure them because they have to tick the boxes. Well, for goodness sake, stop ticking the boxes and focus on the mother and her baby, and then write your notes later. I like writing a story, and I write it contemporaneously as soon as I can. If it's through the labour, I might write as I go. This is at home, and I encourage that in the hospital too. Try not to be tied up with all the rules that go on, because every time we want to do routine procedures on a healthy baby, we're not helping that mother and baby towards her breastfeeding. We're interfering with it. So if we do the routine procedures whenever, later, it doesn't matter. As long as the baby's APGAR score is 7 or above and the baby's maintaining, you know, that energy to be with the mother and locate the breast.
What about if mom and baby are separated for some reason? Say that the APGAR score is very low or there's an emergency cesarean or something like that. Do you have advice for moms that are found in that position?
Again, it's based on the APGAR score at birth. And yes, it's the same principle as if you take the baby, come close to the mother and have your resuscitation or the things that you need closer to the mother, not over there in the corner where she can only hear her baby if it's crying, or she can only hear the voices going on. And it's, you know, and it's difficult for her in that time, except if she's had a general anaesthetic, of course. If she's had a general anaesthetic, she can't communicate. But we can still help her and her baby by being aware and very conscious of having her baby either on her or close to her. And if it's possible, with her partner right beside her side, right beside her with the baby, so there's touching, or until she's really gained her consciousness, you know, and she's back. And I've had that in the hospitals where the babies are popped on the mother's skin with somebody close watching, the midwife's there, and they stay there while that's happening. And that early contact, that gaining confidence with the mother when the baby, by the smell, the baby's nose, the mother's there. And I think we don't think about how intelligent the babies are. Like, you know, they're so intelligent. They'll tell you when they're ready to feed. And they have a series of little things they do. And if we watch that, every single time they're ready to go. So their cues, I call them their cues. And they give the cues. And when they give the cues and the mother says, I've been watching that, I didn't really know. So why aren't we using that as prenatal information? You know, we should be sharing the cues, what the baby does. In lots of, the baby will tell you when it's had enough too. And it changes the oral cavity function at the breast. And then, it you can see it relaxing. And then the baby actually, when it's ready, it'll come off. But if it's there too long, it's okay for the baby's body weight to help it come off the breast if the mother needs the baby to come off. But once it's reached its cue, there's a nerve in the stomach that tells the brain, my stomach is full. And if we learn that from the get-go, we're more inclined to use that information on our stomach as we grow and develop. And I tried it on myself. Using my fist, because a baby's stomach is about the size of its closed fist, as an analogy, and mine's about the size of mine. So I started changing what the volume of food I was eating by using my fist as the example, and I lost heaps of weight. I don't know that I was unduly overweight, but I certainly lost weight and felt really good. So it was just connecting with that sensation that's telling our stomach that our brain that we're satisfied, we've reached enough. And I always encourage, I don't tell people what to do, but I encourage baby feeding from both breasts as much, when possible, each feed, because they take most from one and some from the other, with rest and digest after each breast to give that milk, that first milk chance to break down in the digestive system. And for the gas to rise with the fermentation of the milk in the stomach, and when the baby's stretched out already, it'll burp itself. We don't need to be banging babies on the back. And if we sit them at right angles, it's most uncomfortable because they're all crushed up in there. So a little stretch out's really good. And then after the second rest and digest, generally they're ready to, if they're newborn and young babies, the older babies will be ready to go and play. But the newborn and young babies, they're ready to go back to sleep for a while or rest for a while. And they know when they. So then I suggest the mother starts on the last breast juice first, rests and digest, and then has a second, because that regulates the volume, takes most from this breast this time, and that balances the volume out. And there'll be times when the baby goes on a growth spurt and the baby plateaus and the milk volume changes in that time. But it takes a little time for it to change, but it does change, and then people panic because they don't think they have enough milk. But it's actually regulating. And so watching what the baby does, how the baby swallows, the rhythm, and mothers will tell you they can hear the sound. And watching that helps you understand that the baby's swallowing. But and this is talking about breastfeeding. I simulate that with bottle feeding because I believe mothers have a right to bottle feed, or there are reasons for it. But if we can keep the digestive system calm during that time instead of gravity feeding full on, then the babies find it difficult to come back to the breast if that's what the mother wants, because they expect that feeling in their stomach all the time. There's a whole hundreds of things I could go through.
Now, I think my favorite part of all of this is I'm like, you're a midwife, so for like the pregnancy, labor, birth stuff, but now you switched over to the breastfeeding as we're talking, and I'm like, you're like a midwife for breastfeeding in the sense that it feels very natural. You're just trusting what mom already knows. Like, it's when I was thinking of like what my midwife did for me or what I see midwives do for other people, it's like they just stand there. We're here if you need us. And I'm going to encourage you that what you're doing is great because you already instinctively know. And as I'm listening to you and you're talking about how women know about their babies and they like, we really do understand a lot, and everything that you're saying, I'm like, yes, that was true for me. Yes, that was true for me. And that's because it's these maternal instincts that we have that we're so often told to ignore or taught to ignore. And it kind of turns us away from, I don't know, just that natural instinct that we all have.
Yeah, I have to thank many people, though. Rachel, my head of education now, who's running my academy. I have to thank Rachel Reed in Melbourne for the work that she does. Sarah Buckley, who's been worldwide. Michelle O'Dont, Caroline Flint in the UK. She was amazing. Maggie Leckie Thompson in Australia. She was an amazing, with their home birth practices, they taught me so much in the days gone by. And, of course, they're not practicing now as far as I know either. We're all getting a bit too old, that's why. And I used to travel long distances, so I'd be known as the travelling midwife. I actually flew to Japan for the home birth of my first grandson and had a beautiful home birth with my daughter-in-law. And I also, his Japanese grandmother flew to Melbourne for the birth of my second grandson. So the family were together at those beautiful births. So I was very, very fortunate with that. So I travelled long distances. I went interstate. I went into country areas. I just drove to where people were and sometimes I'd stay somewhere close overnight or sometimes I'd come back home depending on the distance required, depending on what the mother was doing. I've had two babies born before I got there. And I think one mother made that decision. I think she wanted that and she was fine. Her baby was fine. The other mother, her and her partner talked with me on the phone as I was driving and she was in the bath enjoying her labour and birth and she just had her baby as I got there. But that's just a time factor, not giving me enough time to – and probably they might have – but I do think the first mother was very wise. She was choosing that, but she was reassured that I was around coming. Yeah.
Will you take a moment and talk about, so you've developed something called the Thompson Method for breastfeeding, and it's evidence-based care for breastfeeding, and you've kind of talked about some of those really important and really good gold nuggets of information here with how babies work at the breast and all of that. Will you talk about what the Thompson Method is and how that works for women?
Yeah. Well, let me just say I didn't call it the Thompson Method. My professors advised that. And it took me a long time to accept it because it didn't sound like that was going to be too good. But it's an approach based on my research for the breastfeeding. But if I talk about labour, pregnancy, labour and birth, that's different because I was guided by some very special people on journeys over the time. They weren't with me, but they're always there if I needed them. And I went to conferences where they spoke as well. So I was connecting with them. So that was the beginning of that. Then when I decided on breastfeeding, it was because I needed to answer the question when I was doing that maternal and child health work that I spoke about where I was in a large area and visiting women at home. I wanted to know in my brain why so many women were coming home with breastfeeding complications from the hospital. And that's a very short interval now because women don't stay in hospital 10 days anymore. So it's a short interval and they were coming home and I wanted to know why. So I started to look at it and that's how I started to begin to look at the anatomy, at the function, what was happening, why it was happening, how it was happening, how babies were being put to the breast where the mother wasn't actually doing it herself, how the prenatal education hadn't really prepared them for the baby to do the work, you know. So, again, the three golden hours came from that too because of the time that when I really realised it's required for a mother and baby to do what they need to do. And the partners there often helping as well. They're just talking and, you know, generally absolutely blown away with their new baby and in love. And that just, you know, gives that time for that those connections to take place. Now, I understand in the hospital system people become overwhelmed because there's not enough time and I think that's, you know, difficult, but I do think there's a move here in Australia now for more and more women beginning to go back to having their babies at home. There's been women telling their stories of what's happened to them and that's led to a federal government investigation and now that there's a move for more women to to have access to having home birth. So how did I, so I didn't really answer that, did I? I led up to it. So how did I, well, I looked at, I had to look at how babies were feeding, what they were doing. I looked at the maternal breast and looked at each maternal breast individually, not saying they were all the same and they had to do this and they had to do that, and then worked with that mother based on what I was sitting beside her, not touching her baby. I didn't touch the baby. I don't believe that we should touch babies, and I don't believe we should be rubbing them and bouncing them around like I see too on some of the videos. So I sat quietly beside them and I would talk them through what I was seeing. And then, for example, one woman said to me, 3 months, and in my research, in my thesis, you'll see the photographs of her horrific trauma. And she said, oh, my God, she said, there's no pain. She said, it's sensitive, but there's no pain. And that little baby was feeding now over that horrendously damaged nipple. And it was so painful, but now she was reduced in pain. And then when they had their second baby, her husband rang me from the hospital and said, we're scared. And I said, it's okay, just do what you did before and I'll be available if you need me. So they rang me to say, it's all good. So, again, I think prenatal time in the brain, you know, penetrating a mother's brain helps her begin to understand what she can do with her breast, her nipple, and how she chooses to feed her baby.
And so, and is that
the other thing I'm very, sorry.
Go ahead.
The other thing I'm very keen about is babies changing left and right brain. Left and right brain for sleeping and left and right brain for feeding. And that activates all of their survival skills. And that made me, when I was doing my thesis, look up the Mexican, the earthquake in Mexico, when I think it was 10 or 12. Again, my memory's aging, as you know. But the mothers died, only one survived. And the babies lived 10 days, all of them, without food, underground, while the diggers were getting them out. And they were using, I believe, without seeing it, but by what the diggers were saying, the sounds and everything that they were, is that they were using their survival skills. And they were screaming and then they were quiet and I can see them, you know, really distressed, and they're using their Moro reflex, and then a big sound had come and they'd use their startle reflex. And, you know, the adrenaline rushes and I just think if we understand we're developing left and right brain, when the baby changes sides, it's activating both sides. If we stay one side all the time, or we bottle feed one knee all the time, they're not as active with their brain, both sides, left and right brain. Again, that's my own theory. It's not a theory that I've followed anybody with, but it's my own theory after watching little babies for many, many years now.
So can I ask what's involved with your specific method that you have online? I assume this is something it sounds like you believe is really important for women to utilize during pregnancy, and I assume that they can access after pregnancy as well, but having this knowledge going into before they go into postpartum and they're instantly, you know, put ready to breastfeed.
In my program, there's a lot of videos showing it, but I talk about face-to-breast symmetry. I talk about the importance of the omentum, the chin. I talk about the importance of the tongue muscle. I've studied the tongue muscle and how it functions. It has 8 muscles, 4 intrinsic and 4 extrinsic. I talk about the genioglossus muscle, which lengthens the tongue, and I talk about how we're all born with no cartilage here. Our noses turn up perfectly designed to contour the maternal breast. And, you know, I don't look at gaping mouths. I don't believe in gaping mouths. The baby opens, locates the nipple, and then vacuums, and the cheek pads, they are joined to the gums with our dimples, they're our dimples. They're joined with the frenula, and the frenula under the tongue balances and helps lengthen the tongue as well. So I look at that, and then the lips, they just gently curl as the baby draws, they're curling, and then upper lip ends up just here, and you can see a groove either side where it's the baby's at that maternal breast, that unique maternal breast, not the same for everybody, but it's there as that mother feels comfortable. And there's a lot of other little things to do to when you're looking with the unique mother, you know, it's not always the same. So they're minor, they're small things, not minor, they're small things. I have to learn my language because I have a module on language, changing language. It's one of my modules for the students that are doing the academy. I think, yeah, once we understand that and how important that is and how important each individual unique mother can even benefit more by fine-tuning, and I use a fine-tuning for that mother at that time. It's not the same for everybody, and how she's holding her baby is very important. And the craniocervical spine comes into that. We don't interfere with the small brain in the base of the skull behind the occipital bone. It's very important not to interfere with that because you see the baby's reacting to that. And it's the same. I called a specialist on whiplash, a world specialist on whiplash, because I could see the baby's reactions. And he said to me, oh, my goodness, you're onto something. He said, you're absolutely right. He said, I've never dealt with babies because he deals with them with car accidents, you know, the whiplash problem with car accidents. And but he said, keep going. So that encouraged me to keep going. So I've had lots of experiences by asking questions, I suppose, wanting to know why and not thinking that I can do it for the mother. I don't think I can do it at all. That's her baby. It's not my baby. So I think she needs to do it the way she feels right. And then if I can help her, if she's got pain or she's got a nipple that's not the right shape or, you know, or she's got trauma, then I can help her with that. But I don't take her baby at any stage because it's not my baby. And I would only take a baby if the mother offers me or asked me, would I hold her baby while she went to the toilet or something like that, you know. I don't take a baby away from its mother.
Well, that is all wonderful. That's really neat. Thank you so much for your time and your wisdom. I do want the mothers that are listening to know where to find you and where to access your courses and information. So if you have all of that available, I'd love to hear where everyone can go and get access sure. to you.
My beautiful team will do that for me. They even do my diary. My diary is already filled for today. Yeah, so that they look after me and they nurture me, which is really important because that means I can go ahead with what I need to do and I can pass that love and nurturing on to the mothers then.
Yeah. Mm. For those who are listening.
And the fathers. Mm. I always include the fathers and the partners as well if they're around because it's very important that they have the opportunity if they want to be included.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah. Dealing with dads is a really big part for me too. I completely agree. And it's something I wanted my husband to be a part of, obviously. We made this baby together. It's part of our family.
Yeah.
But those who are listening, you can find Dr. Thompson. Her Instagram is the.thompson.method. And her website is thethompsonmethod.com. I will, of course, include all of this in the show notes, all of the links, all of your programs, all the information. And for those who are on the email list, you guys will get all of that in the email this week as well. I want to thank you again for being here and not just for being here, but for everything that you're doing. I believe you have a gift, and I'm so grateful that you're willing to share it with everybody and that you've kind of talked about that process and what you've been willing to do to pursue that. Even just the way that you've been called to this work, I feel extremely grateful to have had this conversation with you. So thank you so much for being here today.
And Stephanie, I feel equally blessed that you've taken your time to spend some time with me. I really do. So thank you.
If you loved what you heard today, the very best way to support this podcast and help other moms to find it is to leave a quick review. I read one at the beginning of the episodes, and I would love for yours to be next. And If you're ready for even more pregnancy, birth, and postpartum goodness, come join me in the My Essential Birth course at myessentialbirth.com, where I will hold your hand and walk you through pregnancy and birth step by step so you're totally prepared for a birth you'll love. See you next week.